another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host and friend, Brantley Smith. Brantley, I'm a little bit excited for this episode. If you can't tell by looking back at my room, I am a musician, and any subject about music always fascinates me and makes me want to just get out a guitar and break out into song. But I will keep the peace and I won't do that. But I recently did a podcast. I don't know if you caught it or not, but we were talking about the power of music as it relates to the New Apostolic Reformation and the methods of persuasion that can be used in that. And I got to thinking, you and I have had many conversations. You are a musician as well, and you were in the music at IHOP KC. And I had one person who actually asked this in the comment feed with that podcast. He said, do more of these. I'm curious to hear more about the music. And I got to thinking, who better to talk to than a musician who's at IHOP KC and talk about the manipulation through worship, which is a fully uncharted territory as it relates to the New Apostolic Reformation investigation. So with that, let's dive into music.
Yeah, no, that's you definitely have more guitars than I do. I got a couple good ones, but that's it. So, but I'm still leading worship on a regular basis. So I'm still in those circles, and it's something I think about a whole lot. What music does to people, how it influences people, which is thoughts that I didn't have. So I've been leading worship since I was 14 years old. So I'm 34 now. So about 20 years that I've been doing corporate worship stuff and have seen, you know, all the highs and lows of that, in the midst of very gnar type environments and prophetic environments, spontaneous environments, and local church as well. And it's kind of a nerdy hobby of mine to look at the things that I'm doing even now and seeing how it affects a room. And I think, I don't know how much you've talked about this on the podcast and stuff, but you know, I'm of the belief that manipulation in and of itself might not be bad, depending on what motivations and what the desired outcomes and stuff are. And so as a worship leader and looking at the experiences that people have and what you want a room to experience, sometimes can be a good thing and help people go on a journey of sorts. But yeah, at the House of Prayer is very central to the DNA. I mean, it's harp and bowl, and yeah, it's a big topic. So where are we going to start?
Well, I guess something you said is where we start. Manipulation's not always bad. That is something that it took me a while to realize after coming out of a destructive cult. When you come out of something like this, any form of manipulation, if you detect it or sense it, immediately your guard goes up, you become heightened in awareness, you're over hypercritical, I should say, and whoever is doing it, you're angry at them. I was that way, and here's the sad part. You will be in a business meeting for me, but for most people, you'll be in at your employer, and your employer will invite somebody in who's a speaker, motivational speaker, something like this, and you'll detect it, and you'll be instantly angry at the world. And for me, it was actually starting to show in business meetings. There was a period of time I got so angry, I handed most of my business meetings over to one of my contractors and just let them take over for me, which is kind of funny. But I couldn't help it, because you are so in tune with that manipulation. But there are techniques of manipulation that are good. I always recommend people read the book Propaganda by Edward Bernays, I think it is, Sigmund Freud's nephew. Oh. That book really describes how to achieve mass psychology, and it walks you through exactly what leaders in the New Apostolic Reformation are doing, what Branham was doing, what you can go back down through time, and you can literally go back through all of the charismatic figures who had a massive stage presence. And they're using techniques. Now, are they all bad? Not necessarily. But here's where the problem lies. With the business meeting example, somebody comes in, he or she's doing a motivational speech, and they're using psychological techniques to make you very excited about working and feel good about yourself, feel good about the company, and you can detect it. That's why you get a little bit upset. That's why I got a little bit upset. But what they're doing is actually energizing the employees of a workforce in that case.
Yeah.
Take it to a church, you can do the same thing. You can energize people to be on fire for Jesus. That's not necessarily bad. Here's where the problem lies. A lot of times these churches will do it insidiously and inject their extra-biblical doctrines into that platform. So they realize the power of manipulation, they realize the power it has over the crowd, and we have this obscure doctrine that only we have. The other churches down the road don't have it. Let's inject that into our singing. And once I learn how it all works, I'm one of these mechanically minded people. I just want to, you know, open the hood and see what the engine's running. I just started going down through all of the songs that we had that were only special to us in the destructive group. And oh my gosh, man, I'm starting to realize they're using psychological techniques through music to manipulate my head. And the power of it was so strong that during the day, during the week, you're not in service. You know, you go on Sunday, and for us, we didn't go back until Wednesday. For average person, it's not until next Sunday. So from Sunday to Wednesday and from Thursday to next Sunday, those songs were resonating in my head, and I would be working and thinking about them. And what I was doing, I was literally brainwashing myself with the lyrics. Yeah. But not simply because of the lyrics, it was more about the beats and the rhythms and the progressions, the chord progressions. You know what I'm talking about. So I just want to talk about the dynamics of how all that works.
Yeah, it's interesting. As you're talking about it, Misty is the one who comes to mind, Misty Edwards. It's kind of inside joke with IHOPers that you can kind of start a sentence or say a phrase and finish it with a Misty lyric. And it's because a lot of it was so formative and impactful. And what's funny is some of it was Mike's language that Misty would then sing. She had this one that's kind of, it's definitely a meme in our circles now, but if you don't quit, you win. And she would sing this thing of, if you don't quit, you win. And I can't tell you how many people didn't quit because they wanted to win. So that's, you know, that was one of the things that kept us there and kept us in the moment. But there was always, it was a vehicle for the theology and the message. It was a whole lot easier to sing, because IHOP was very eschatology forward. It was a whole lot easier to sing about the judgments of God than to have to talk about them and have a conversation about them, to say that just and true are your judgments, O God, which is scripture, but at IHOP it means something totally different. That was a whole lot more palatable for people. And what was interesting too is it was even a vehicle for the prophetic history and the lore and the storytelling. I don't know, have you heard a lot of IHOP music at all?
I've heard some, not a lot. I'll be honest, I'm still triggered greatly by listening to Christian music, and something that I'm working through. My wife, it's interesting, my wife are two different personalities. She is just excited to hear it like nonstop, 24/7. You get in the car, she's playing it, and my head's going, no, stop this. And she's become aware of this, and now she'll put on something that's calm for both of us. But I have listened to it. I don't like it. I don't like to listen to it. And heck no, you're not going to manipulate my head.
There was one song that Misty would do, and she would always, I feel like I've talked about this somewhere and I can't remember if it was with you or not, but about waiting for the rain. I can't remember exactly what the song was called, but the verse went something like that. I've heard the story told of the prophet who prophesied of the rain that would come in the middle of the drought that would tell of the rains to come. That was the first verse. It's crazy that I can still remember it like that. And it sounds very riddled and, like, you know, mysterious, metaphoric. And what she was talking about was one of Bob Jones's words, in the early days of Metro before IHOP KC. I may butcher the details, but there was this prophetic word about a drought that would happen and that there would be rain, and it would symbolize the coming revival, which to IHOP meant the great end time revival. And so at times it was at staff meetings, at anniversaries and things, Misty would break out this song, and it would just be her and piano a lot of times. Every once in a while, she'd play with full band. And the course was, we're still waiting for the rain. We're still waiting for the rain. And then she would always go off into some kind of spontaneous thing of how we still believe the promises. And she would start, it was all spontaneous kind of stuff. She would sing the phrases that we still believe that there's going to be 500 to 5,000 overnight. We still believe that no disease known to man will stand. We still believe, you know, and she would rattle off these prophetic promises, quote unquote, from the prophetic history. And it was almost like a plumb line to the messaging, to the framework that we were all kind of buying into, which I think at this point we've seen that there's tons of holes in it. And, you know, it's a lot of it was fabricated and this and that. But it's really interesting to see how much that music does shape a culture. Have you talked about Bob Sorge at all in any of your podcasts, or are you familiar with him at all?
No, I haven't. The name sounds familiar. I think I've came across him in my research, but I've not talked about him.
Yeah, it depends on where you're coming into the IHOP circles at. Bob's a prolific author. I think most of his books were published through Destiny, I think, which, you know, just a charismatic publisher. And I think they published some of Mike's books as well. I actually found Bob before I found The House of Prayer and read some of his books. But Bob Sorge was a worship leader and had some kind of vocal operation and lost his voice. And barely can speak above a whisper now. And so he wrote his I think his most famous book is called Secrets of the Secret Place or something. It's a book on prayer. But didn't realize that he was a big part of that community there. His wife was on the board of directors, Marcy Sorge. And she was kind of one of, from what I hear, what the claims are is that she was kind of one of Mike's enforcers in the back room and put a female face to it, I guess supposed to make it more palatable and stuff. But Bob himself wasn't super involved in the leadership stuff and the day-to-day stuff, but Marcy was very integral. And he had children that were involved doing music and stuff. And some of them are on the backside of things, probably in a healthier spot now. I don't know if all of them are, but I would hope that they are. But Bob wrote this book that was given to me. Whenever I first went to IHOP, I joined the Music Academy, which was their place where they're supposed to be training prophetic singers and musicians and worship leaders. And almost like the way that it was pitched to us was almost like a farm system for the prayer movement. Like, this is where the talent will be developed, and you all will be the next Misties and Matt Gilmans and Corey Asbury's and all these different people. And one of the first books that was handed to me was Bob Sorge's little pamphlet book, and it was called Following the River is what it was. It was a book that he had wrote on worship leading. And I held on to it for a long time, but I think I eventually tossed it. But he also had some bigger books called Exploring Worship, and they were guides on worship leading, almost like Mike's Harp and Bowl manuals. I don't know if you've seen those. Are kind of almost like a size of paper kind of book that's kind of bound together, like a normal printer paper kind of size. But what Bob did was kind of paint this spiritual picture of worship leading, of like the ebbs and flows of a journey, which if you've ever been in a charismatic worship service, they kind of, and even evangelical nowadays, they're taking, because evangelicals take the majority of their cues, I feel like, from the charismatic worship movement and don't even realize it. Your evangelical churches are playing the Hillsong and the Bethel and all these things, and they have no idea how insane their theology can actually be. But usually, whenever you step into a charismatic worship service, one of the first things you're either going to have at IHOP, you're either going to have something that's like super slow and focusing that gets everybody calm and down into a focused moment, a tender moment, where we're singing something like "Come, Lord Jesus," "Come, Holy Spirit," something of that nature. And then right after that, usually you're doing something that's four on the floor, you're 120 BPM, you're pounding, you know. And gets the heart rate up, gets going. So sometimes you wouldn't have that first little calming one. You might just go straight into an upbeat song. And that's kind of a similar thing to what I would do on a Sunday morning now. But there's this ebb and flow. And if you keep doing that 120 BPM for, you know, a 2-hour prayer meeting or an hour long worship service at IHOP, that's how long corporate worship lasted, you're going to get people like very fatigued very quickly. So you had this kind of journey that people would go on. And what Bob was attempting to do, I think, was spiritualize that journey a little bit, like give spiritual language to it rather than approaching it honestly, like we are, with being like it's a little manipulative and it's taking people on a journey and it is what it is. And so after you do an upbeat song, maybe you would do something that's a little bit more reflective and give people a breather. And I remember during the student awakening, we were having these extended meetings all the time and extended worship nights at the FCF building. And it was funny. It was almost like clockwork that you would have maybe a lull in the night and you could just tell there wasn't a whole lot going on. There wasn't a whole lot of testimonies to be shared. And there was a couple of songs that were just high energy that they would just switch to and play out depending on who was leading worship. Justin Rizzo, it was his brother would sing this thing about my dad. He's not angry. He's not disappointed in me. And the whole place would go nuts. Almost, it would remind you very akin to like something that like Toronto with like holy laughter and joy and all this kind of thing. And people were just like, my dad's not angry. With Corey Asbury, it might have been something like Shekinah Glory Come, and people, you know, would be, we want the fullness of the Spirit. It was like a big thing. It would bring people, but there were certain songs that they could play that would just make the room go nuts. It's almost like having like Sweet Caroline come on at a baseball game or something. Like it just, everybody knew what to do. They knew how to play the part and we're going to hit the oh, like every time, like we know what we're doing. It's interesting to see that, you know, people try to give language to it, like Bob Sorge, and that these things can be, that's the thing that people don't realize, I don't think, is that these things can be learned. It's a whole other conversation for another day, but you have the phrase anointed thrown out all the time. Like this is anointed. This is that, this is this. And I can't tell you how many times people call something anointed. That's just really good tactics is what it is. It's good planning. It's good. Like knowing how to to have a moment. And I tell people that all the time, whenever it comes to like leading worship on a Sunday morning, the most impactful times for people are not the times that I expect usually. But there's a system that I kind of follow with things that, you know, gets predictable outcomes, I guess, predictable results. And I'll have a day when my voice is gone and I feel like I'm having the worst Sunday of my life. And somebody comes up to me in tears at the end. They're like, thank you so much. This was the best Sunday ever. The Lord spoke to me. Da, 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 da. And then the day that I think that I killed it, you know, everybody's like, nobody says anything. And so it's such a big topic, such a big topic.
It is. And, you know, to a non-musician, I don't know that they'll even understand anything we're talking about. But if you're a musician, you understand that there are mechanics of the music that excite people. Yeah. And if you're an entry-level musician, you probably don't know these things. But once you understand how music works and you get into the architecture of music, there are things like, so you mentioned Sweet Caroline. Bom, yeah. Bom, bom. Why does this work? It's because the bom, bom, bom is a response to the previous phrase. Yeah. You sing the phrase, then the response. Yeah. And in music, this is one of the most powerful techniques. Phrase, response, phrase, response. The other thing you mentioned was the fast beat. So fast beat, whenever you're listening to music, especially if you've got the bass and the drums, which most NAR people do, we weren't allowed, interestingly, in the cults that I grew up, but with the bass and the drums, that pulsation, it flows through your body. Yeah. So if you are not, I hate to use the word if you're easily subjected, because that's not the case. If you are, what's the word? If the music is resonating with you, your heart starts to match the beat. literally resonating with you. Your heart starts to match that beat. Yeah. So you can make people anxious through the music. Yes. And with that anxiety, if you use the right words, you can program that anxiety, you can program the response to anxiousness to the lyrics. And so there's this mechanical strategy that not many people really think about. If you are a inclusive cult and you want to talk about the bad guys who are the church down the street, well, you talk about the bad guys in the anxiety part of the music when the beat gets really heavy. And at the same time, you can slow the beat down and you can bring people down to a calm. Well, that's when you give the peace of the central figure and what is his doctrine. And when you pick up on this, it's kind of funny because I recognized that while I was in the group. even though I didn't see the destructive power of it, but I recognized it and I started to try to match this because that's how it works. That's the mechanics of the architecture of the music. Well, I was doing the same thing without knowing it. So there are people who unknowingly will manipulate heads just because they recognize the patterns. And it's like, I don't know, it's like a Sudoku puzzle. Once you figure out the patterns, it's exciting to do those patterns, right? Yeah. Yeah. So I did this. There are other things, just the chord progressions themselves. So dun, 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 that's leading into a different chord. And that leading to the other chord, it gives you this sense of transition that's powerful.
Yeah.
And one of the most powerful transitions, everybody's heard it, it's that same progression, but go to a minor instead. Bum, bum, bum. When you get that minor chord, now you're getting people to, oh my gosh, let's pay attention. Let's think through this.
That was a big IHOP trick. Big IHOP trick.
It's powerful, man. People don't realize. And that's why you have so many minor chords in Christian music, sadly. It's a little odd. I remember after I left the cult, it was a different church. I won't mention the name of the denomination, but they were playing popular Christian radio music, which I don't listen to. I've actually never listened to it. We weren't allowed to.
Hey, loves.
Yeah. So we're listening to things that it's constant progressions, man. It's like, I as a musician, and I'm playing, and I'm like, this is a little bit monotonous. This is exciting one or two times, but to continue doing this over and over and over, what are you doing, man? And I started to pick up on the fact that, oh, I see what they're doing. They're using the power of that progression for that word and or that phrase. And then I'm like, no, man, this is wrong.
Yeah, talking about the minor, like, it was always the joke. So at IHOP, we used what's called the Nashville number system. Like, all the musicians used it, and it's just a way of being able to quickly, like, communicate where to go spontaneously with music. And it assigns a number to, like, a chord or a note in this scale. So, like, basic music, C, D, E, F, G, A, B, C would be like a C scale. So C would be 1, D would be 2, E would be 3, that kind of thing. And so, like, in the key of C, A minor, which is your 6, is where we would always end up going during intercession sets and stuff. And it was always a little thumbs up symbol. That's how we communicated a 6 to people. So, cause you got 5 fingers, it'd be 6 and 7. And, so you would always see, as soon as we were going to do intercession or something intense, or there was going to be an altar call, or like there was something of that nature, you'd always see somebody on the stage, worship leader, somebody throw a little thumbs up behind there. And it was so predictable. And all of a sudden here would come the big reverb guitar, and which is a whole other thing too. Maybe we'll talk about here in a second. but it got that intensity and that fervor kind of feeling with the minor keys. And I it was very awkward whenever you had a happy major sounding intercession set. Like, it was kind of off-putting, and there was some people who would do it, but it was almost an unwritten rule that you had to go to the minor whenever we were going to pray serious, because minor is serious. But it made me think of some of those songs that you were talking about that are kind of the way that the beats and the key kind of shapes the environment, sets the tone. Misty had this one that was based off of a dream that she had. And it was, I think it was called People Get Ready, I think is what it was called. Not the Twyla Paris or whoever it was that did it before, but and it was this very, like, people get ready, Jesus is coming, he's coming. It would be like a cymbal wash and like, do, 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 do. But she had this thing in this dream where she sees Jesus as the Lion of the Tribe of Judah, and she hears this rhythm is what it is. And so this whole, like, kind of verse section of this song is, I can hear the rhythm of the Lion of the Tribe of Judah. And behind it, she's got the drums are going like, bum, 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 bum. And that's that, like, what you're talking about, the anxiety inducing, like the pensive kind of, like, what's going to happen, what's going to happen. And then all of a sudden she gets, people get ready. And I mean, and Misty had this, like, if you've never listened to Misty before, I encourage you to, like, go just experience it one time, to go look up one of her maybe like the Relentless record or something that she had, because what she was doing was really, I don't want to shortchange it, because it was brilliant, to be honest. And she has this quality very similar to, like, a I don't know exactly how to describe it. I don't know that gothic is the right word, but like this Evanescence kind of, if you're familiar with the band Evanescence, this kind of like eerie, high, like kind of thing that she would do. But she had that song. She had another one that she called it as In the Days of Noah. And she would talk about how it's never rained before, but it was, again, it was that shrilly, it's never rained before kind of thing. And then it would be like real big. And like, there was like little melodic parts that she was very gifted at what she did. But it reminded me of the bum, 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 bum. She had this little part like that was just an earworm is what it was. People walking around with their fingers in their ears singing, bum, 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 bum. I don't want to hear the sound. And like, which we memed a whole lot whenever the Mike Bickle stuff happened, where people walking around with their fingers in their ears. But it was such a unique expression of music at the House of Prayer, I guess, that you don't see anywhere else. But yeah, I don't know if you have any thoughts about that before I jump to something else. But
well, instantly you said bum 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 bum, and then the phrase. Well, that's even more powerful than the one that I talked about, where there's a follow up and a response to the music. Well, the response is the lyrics. So people, they skip that beat and then they're anticipating the response. And then the response is like triple powerful. It's really crazy when you think about it. The only thing that really came to mind while you're talking, I play electric guitar as well. And in the church, the cults that I grew up, it was taboo to play any sort of electric instrument. That was instantly devil music, man, because of
hide the overdrive.
I went to some churches that had it, and they might as well have been playing an acoustic, because you weren't allowed to even put effects on it, man. It was like, this is the most plain humdrum music. Anyway, after this, I started listening to new worship music in the new churches. And there's another thing they do powerful that goes along with what you were saying. You're talking about the drum beat and the progression. Well, a lot of people don't realize this, but who's the good example? Bon Jovi is probably the best example of doing this. You put a lot of distortion on the guitar and you do the angry strings, which are ones on the top, and you go dun, 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 dun. When you're doing this, it has the same effect on the heart as the beat does with the drums, and you get in that and you get that anxiety built up. And the power of that is you can actually have a slower song, but in between the beats, dun, 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 you're doing this. Well, in that slow song, now you've got the power of that heart rhythm. And yeah, that's, I mean, Bon Jovi is excessively popular for this, so you can see how much it works. Do that to a Christian music and then add your destructive lyrics into it, and it's a combination for disaster, man.
No, nobody can build a song like a charismatic church. Nobody. They're like, you if you ever play with a drummer who has never played in charismatic church stuff, they will think that you're insane. With the amount of building and layers to dynamics, as you're talking about that, I was thinking about a song that we played this past Sunday. There's this song called All Hail King Jesus, and it's kind of, if people go to church, they've probably heard it before, but it's pretty chill, I would say. But there's this part after the first chorus where the instrumental kind of picks up, but it's not like big dynamic. What ends up happening is the drummer comes in on the ride cymbal going ting, 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 and everybody else kind of builds it just a little bit, and it gives it enough to like start going somewhere. And so like, there's all these different layers, and that was always a thing that like IHOP was just brilliant at. And you started seeing, I wish that we could track it down, but I really think that aspect was something that IHOP influenced in the Christian music industry at large, that we started seeing it more at Bethel, because people are like, even from the circles would make fun of us because of how long we would build stuff. But now you go back and look, and everybody's got five bridges to a song, and everybody's got these big builds and big massive moments. And, but it's the same thing. It's you're getting an emotional response out of people. Like as you build, 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 and then you have the payoff moment. And it's just ecstasy is like what happens in those moments. I'm curious to hear what, because I teased this a second ago, talking about reverbs and delays and how it's used. So a lot of Christian music now is kind of like the synth pads underneath, the soft synth pads. You got big reverbs and delays on the electric guitar, to the point that you can take a unskilled guitarist and teach them a couple of notes and they can hit those three notes over the course of the song. And it's big enough because of the reverbs and delays that it fills space, you know? But I'm curious to hear what you think about, that as a technique and what you think that it might do.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Latter Rain, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
I'm laughing because in the first church that we went to after leaving the cult, I brought my music. I started playing different instruments, and I'm playing it pretty much everything that you see here, not the cello because I didn't have it then, but everything I had here, I would bring two or three to every service and just kind of juggle which ones I'm playing. With me was a guy who was really, really, really good on the rhythm guitar, probably one of the best rhythm guitarists I've played with. And it was just me and him for a while on the guitars, and then there was a drummer, there was a pianist, and an organ player. So that was the band, basically, and we were really, really good. Well, this new guy shows up one Sunday, and he is an electric guitarist, and they said, John, we want this guy to play with you. And he played with us, I don't know, it was probably three or four Sundays, and I'm just like, you know, I don't know that this is really adding much to it, but the people enjoy it. And in one of the conversations I had with the real guitarist later, he said, John, have you watched that guy play? And I said, no, but I've heard it, and it's a little bit monotonous. And he says, watch him next Sunday. So I go back next Sunday, and we're playing in B flat. And
just this, hold the flat the whole time.
This guy is holding the key of D and going dun 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 the whole song, man. And it here's the funny part. We would change to a minor, we would change to a major, we'd change to a flat. It's still D. And I'm like,
oh no.
How do people not know that this is not even in the key we're playing in? Well, like, he had so much dang reverb, you couldn't tell. He had so much reverb. And so as far as manipulation, I guess that's manipulation in the opposite direction, because the real musicians are like, no, this is painful. And that's how I was. This is painful. What is happening here? But, you know, back to another point that you made, I wanted to talk about. You mentioned an earworm, and that's a funny phrase for me, because I grew up playing in Georgia, and that's a common phrase, an earworm. Yeah, yeah. To those who don't know what this is, it's something that it gets in your ear and gets in your head.
Is that a bluegrassy phrase? I don't know.
It's a bluegrassy phrase. Once it gets in your head, you can't get it out. Yeah. The music is so appealing, and the phrase is so appealing. Well, the power of the earworm in Christian music is unbelievable. You can take phrases like, and I'm just going to make something up off the fly, but you can say something like, I know I feel it, I won't let go, I'm stepping on faith because you told me so. That's a highly repeatable, rhymeable. If you add all of the dynamics that I'm mentioning, that's pretty good, right? And I'm pretty good off the fly sometimes. But if you think about what that's saying, I know I feel it, I won't let it go, it's emphasizing the feeling over the doctrine.
Yeah.
If you really break this down, this is a really bad phrase I just invented, so I should go to hell for this phrase. I'm stepping in faith because you told me so. Well, this emphasizes the feeling over the doctrine, the inside voice, whatever it is, your conscience, your imagination, whatever it is, that is what told you. You can't prove that God told you this. Well, to the audience who's listening, they want to repeat this once it's an earworm in their ear, and they start seeing God talking to them in ways that God is not talking to them. They might meet somebody on the street in the grocery store who says something like, you probably shouldn't yell at your kids, and God spoke to me and told me I need to be nicer to my kid. I mean, stupid stuff like that people are doing, and it's because of the earworm in the music, and they don't even realize it.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times, good and bad, in my life that I've had something happen and a worship song come back into my head, just because some of those things are so catchy. And what's interesting too is you have to think about the environment that the music's happening in as well, is a very important part of it. That whenever people, for whatever the reasons, thinking outside the cult world for a second, whatever reason a person shows up to a church on a Sunday morning, that influences how receptive they are to things. And so if they're showing up to your church on a Sunday because they believe that it's a safe sanctuary, a place to where they can, you know, find solace and peace, then they're going to be much more receptive to whatever you're saying, because they're going to go in with that mindset. In charismatic circles, I hope this gets a rouse out of you. Surely this is something that y'all had too, that one of the big things is the preacher would come up and go, are you expecting tonight? Are you expectant? what's your expectation? And that's another tool that's used, that there's this, if everybody in the room is convinced that God is going to come down and meet them, after we do our 20-minute build and we get to that big payoff moment, they're expecting something, and something is going to happen. And that's the moment that I have to look at, like, things that Mike Bickle said about, like, Hamburger Helper, and be like, yeah, like, some of that is fake. It's because people want to feel that. And that's not even necessarily bad either, that people want to have a good feeling in a moment. And I think about that now in post-cult life, of how much coping I did in worship services, because it allowed room for those big emotions, whether that was my anxiety, whether that was my anger, whatever it might be. If I was down and depressed, man, you give me four on the floor and a happy song, and now I'm feeling depressed, man, and that will turn around my week. Whenever I was growing up, it's a little harder now, but because I know the tricks. But yeah, it's so influential, and I can't remember how I journeyed to this spot, but there we are. But I was going to say about reverbs and delays, like, I think it's soothing, I think, is what it is. It creates so much space, and you feel enveloped, and it feels good, is what it is. It, like, there's nothing like a preacher doing an altar call and having a little atmosphere behind them. It just sets the mood.
Yeah. Yeah, and like you said, it's not that destructive to say that you're anticipating or expecting. In fact, I always, whenever I do listen to Christian music that is comfortable to me and doesn't trigger me, it's usually the old music from the old songbooks, because in general, these people were under inspiration. They were writing songs, not as a technique. That's really where I have a problem. If you write a song as a technique or a manipulation tool, you're evil. I'm just going to say it like that. You're evil. But I listen to those songs from those old songbooks, and they don't trigger me so badly, and I'm familiar with them. But combine that, what you just said, the expectation, you can add that into the music. We're expecting the word's going to fall today, or, you know, whatever is the phrase, and build it up in that Sweet Caroline bum, bum, bum with that anticipation. Well, you build the anticipation, then the expectation of the Lord, then the speaker comes, and the speaker has the rhema or the spoken word or whatever he claims or she claims that they have from God. Well, you have just programmed the people that you're expecting the thing to come. Now the speaker comes out and he has introduced the thing to come. It's not him. It's a divine being speaking through his or her mouth. Well, that progression, that's an architectural disaster. You have really programmed the people to open up in ways that they should never open up their minds. And once they do, you hijack their minds. And that's what I see happening in not only the music, but in music is just one aspect of manipulation, but in the music they're doing it in other techniques, verbal. Even I've seen, like, some of the, I was in one church, and even the posters on the wall as you're walking in the foyer to get into the building, even that was a manipulation technique. And is it bad? Not all, but some of it, especially when the leader has the spoken word, the rhema, this nonsense, that's evil, man.
I've had many times after leading worship that I hear a preacher say something. Because if you talk to like a preacher, like behind closed doors and stuff, they'll tell you that kind of the worship leader's responsibility, maybe not all of them, but a lot of them will, that the worship leader's responsibility is to prepare people's hearts for the word, kind of thing. Like that's, and that's how they see it. And unfortunately, it's kind of right, like you're saying. Like it does, it puts people, and I think it's why a lot of times we don't end sets before somebody preaches a sermon with a dance party. Like that's usually not how you do it. You might end the service with a dance party, but you're not going to do that right before the preacher comes up. And so it's going to be more reflective and calm and focused. And that puts people in a place to be more open. And I've heard preachers say things in moments that I look around the room and everybody's nodding in agreement. And I'm like, do you guys hear what he's saying? Like, are you thinking logically right now? Like, he just said that he knows that this is certain for sure, 100% the answer. This is widely theologically debated, and he's certain on this. And like, are you guys listening? Like, what's going on? But I see that happen all the time, in local church context and even in Kansas City. I mean, Mike, like you go back and listen to the things that Mike said, like there was Freudian slips all the time. And things that he would say that like now in hindsight, you're like, my gosh, he was telling us exactly what's happening. And we just couldn't see it. The music, the lyrics, it's conditioning. As you're talking, this is a little bit of a bunny trail again, but there was another chorus that Misty would sing. And I remember it popping my head all the time. It was, you owe me nothing, I deserve hell. You owe me nothing, but you've given me mercy. And that does something. Like, you know, people can have their, and I know the YouTube comment section loves me because I say a lot of heretical things. But and I love you guys too. It's no hard feelings. But whenever you have somebody sing over and over that they deserve hell, that you owe me nothing, I deserve hell, like it does something to your psyche. And I think with where I'm at on my journey, I think those doctrines like original sin and total depravity and stuff, it has the tendency to do the same things that these mind control type things do. It convinces you that you're a little peon, you're a little worm, a little, your excrement is what you are. And whenever you start to believe that, you start to treat yourself that way. And whenever you treat yourself poorly, like Jesus himself says, love your neighbor as you love yourself, like as you love yourself. If you can't love yourself, then how in the world are you going to love somebody? And I think that that's like one of our, sorry, this is my sermonette. I have one every week. It just comes at some moment. But that's whenever we look at like empathy, like toxic empathy is like the big thing right now that people want to talk about. But like, if you can't show compassion towards yourself and be loving toward yourself because you think that you deserve hell and that you don't get anything, you're a piece of junk is what you are. Whenever you think that about yourself, it's really easy to think that about other people. So whenever you see bad things happening to other people, you're like, yeah, but they deserve that. That's what they deserve. And that's whenever we lose our humanity in those moments, I think. But that's what this music does. And whenever you get convinced of those things that you do deserve hell, it makes you dependent on these messengers of God is what it is. Like, I deserve hell. That they have what I need. I have to stay here. And those were the fear tactics that were used by Mike and others in backhanded ways of... He would always give the speech, and I've said this a million times like a broken record. He would talk about, you know, some people do this prayer movement stuff for a little bit, and then they burn out and they move on. And some people last a decade, and they burn out and they move on. And he's like, but God's looking for the ones who will do it for decades, who believe the promises. And he would say, you know, you can go and be in a local church and this and that, but we want the people who believe the promises. Like, it was this elite thing, and you felt like if you walked away from it, that, like, sometimes I think the equivalency is like, you almost thought like, would I die if I walked away? And that's kind of like the internal stuff that would happen. And I got way serious, way too quick, but that's the power of the music. It really is.
Yeah. And I'm going to join you in the comment feeds. You can slaughter me too in the comment feeds if you want, but I fully agree with you. I've mentioned this to some extent, And people, you know, people will try to nail me down. Are you Calvinist? Are you not? And
I still can't figure you out, and I have private conversations with you.
Yeah, you're not going to figure me out, man. But here's the thing. I've mentioned this before. As it relates to the total depravity doctrine, there are people who say that's scriptural. That's absolutely scriptural. And they'll rattle off all of the scriptures that I already know. I already know this. It's in my head. But I know the other scriptures that take it out of the ballpark of what you're trying to say. That's really the difference. If you're in one mindset, it's like you're in this box and you can't see outside of the box. So not to get onto a preacher's high horse, high platform, because I'm definitely not a preacher. You go talk to your pastor about this stuff. But most of the passages that are being used for this, remember, there is a timeline in the Gospels. Jesus comes to earth. All of the children of Israel had been under this, it was bigger than a contract, but it was this contractual agreement was part of the old covenant. And the contractual agreement said, if you do these things, I'll give these blessings. If you don't, you'll get these curses. Well, they went down the wrong path and they got the curses, right? So Jesus is, when he's saying things that really support what they're trying to say with total depravity, he's speaking to a people that were in total depravity. It's not saying that you who I've been in a church that they actually targeted the four-year-olds and said they're totally deprived, they're evil, that, you know, it's just awful doctrine. And I've mentioned it before, if you keep pounding on people like this and you keep talking about how bad they are, everything that Brantley just said, that's going to happen. You're going to hate yourself, you're going to hate the people around you. Anybody who's not in your church, you absolutely hate those. I mean, there's no limit to how bad this is. And you don't even train a dog like this. If you're constantly telling the dog, bad boy, well, the dog is going to be a bad boy. I mean, that's how dogs work. That's how humans work. Yep. You can't raise humans like this. To some extent, I understand the doctrine as it relates to adults. If you're an adult and you're trying to understand the scripture, at least do it correctly and apply the passages correctly, those that were applied to Israel and those that are applied to the Gentiles. But if you go beyond that, just think through the fact that as an adult, you can decipher between those two because it takes a broad understanding of the Bible to do that. But to a teenager, to somebody who's just barely learning about the world around them, how are they going to do this in the way that an adult can? They're going to be depressed. And I know this because I fell into that category. I was one of these people. Yeah. I've been there, man. I know how this works. And that's another part of the reason I'm triggered by the music. You find that language in the music, but in such a beat and a chord progression that it gets stuck in your head all day. And it is gloom and doom and, oh, I hate the world. I hate myself. It's one step away from, there's this category, this genre of rock that's like suicide rock. It's for those that are just so depressed they can barely survive. That's what it is to me. It's like you're listening to suicide music when you do this, man. Don't do this. Instead of talking about depravity, talk about ways that you can be excited about Christianity, excited about the world, and you'll be less triggering to those people who are actually suffering.
Yeah, it gets so nihilistic so quickly. Like with IHOP, it was the eschatology. Like if And it was fun. There was a little bit of split between people. But the present day, there was so much talked about like eternal mindset and stuff, but the present day and the present moment didn't matter a whole lot because we had eternity. And then outside of that, like a lot of them believe that God was going to destroy the world we're sitting on right now. And that he was going to create a new world. And so that there was no need for stewardship, like it's talked about in Genesis 1, of tending and taking care of the earth and keeping the garden and all that kind of thing. It wasn't until I stepped out of NAR circles that I started hearing Christians talk about ecology and like the ecosystems and taking care of the planet as Christian work. Like I that was just like something that was so and it's because like you live in this way that you think everything's going to be destroyed and everything's going to end and then there's no point in the here and now except like the short-term gains and that I had to get to the point in my life where I had to put all of that stuff on the shelf because it drove me for so long. The Eternal Mindset. Misty had an album called Eternity. That's what it was. Eternity, eternal song. It's so like, I mean, this kind of stuff. I mean, it goes deep and the music's right there with it. And that's the thing, that it reinforces it. But I had to get to a point to where I put that stuff on a shelf because I realized I wasn't living life is what was happening. I was so worried about the future. I was so worried about my past mistakes that I couldn't live in the moment. I couldn't be present for my family. I couldn't be present for friends. I couldn't be supportive of anybody. I was barely making it myself. And so I had to come to this conclusion that I was like, you know, heaven and hell can be what it is. Like, I know that I am trying to love best I can. I'm trying to follow Jesus best I can. And if he sends me to hell for that, he sends me to hell for that. Like, that's what's going to happen. I'm not going to spend time worrying about it because fear doesn't do anything. If you live in a cult for any amount of time, you realize fear is such a powerful tool. And so I had to set that fear aside. And even with heaven, I'm like, man, like, if I want to live life now and I want to make the world around me as good as I can here and now, like, and eternity be damned. Like, that's kind of where I've had to live my life. But doing that has helped me reprogram my brain, rewire my brain and into a healthier spot to where now I can have conversations about this stuff. We can talk about hell and depravity and all these things, and my nervous system doesn't freak out. I had a huge freak out. Man, this was probably 10 years ago, something like that, in a conversation about hell with someone. But growing up in NAR and Pentecostal holiness environments and stuff, like, hell was held over your head all the time. And I eventually had to get to a spot where, you know, it is what it is. Whatever it is. And there's nothing I can do to change that. But it didn't do me any good to be living fear of that. But
yeah, absolutely. And what you're talking about basically is you're coming to a realization that there has to be balance. Martin Luther, I've mentioned this before, but and I still need to go find his exact verbiage, but he says something to the effect of, they preach hell in these churches that we left, and he's talking about the Catholic Church, and he's essentially describing they're using it as a weapon. And he says, I don't have a single member in my congregation that wants to go there, so why would I want to preach on something for a people who aren't wanting to hear more about it? Let's instead preach about heaven. Let's talk about heavenly things. And I look at that, and I think, it's so odd that the Protestant church has actually gone in reverse. There's so many ways that they resemble what Martin Luther was crying out against. And that's just, we could probably do another podcast on just simply that. But the music itself, I feel, so we have probably scared people listening to music at this point. I feel that we should probably balance that scale, because
you need to listen to some Doc Watson. That's what everybody needs. Yeah. A little bluegrass in their life.
Yeah. You know, Steve Martin, he says, there's not a way that you can play a song with a banjo and make it sound angry. He's talking about the techniques, man. You can really change people's perspective with music. Yeah. And how it's played, and even the instruments you play. But so let's do this. Let's talk about a bit about the healthy things that music has in it. So you and I, we struggle more than the average person because we're musicians and because we were in a destructive cult. We actually have it worse, and I don't know if people realize that, but we do. And it's especially worse because I think you and I both are also empaths. So where everybody else is down here on the scale of this was torture, we're so far beyond that. I get everything that you're saying. And, you know, to the point, if you're bringing music in a healthy way, even if you're using techniques of manipulation in the music, and manipulation is probably the wrong word in this case, music can be used to comfort.
Yeah.
You can go to church, you can be comforted, you can feel blessed, you can feel secure. You can bring in, you can use the same techniques, and you can have the entire people in this blessing and security atmosphere before the sermon comes. That's a way that you could do the same exact things for good, not for bad. You could do it for inspiration. You could inspire people to do good to other people, and they could leave the church and they could go help the community. They could help the people in the other churches. They could even help the people who won't go to church. That's an inspiration. That's something that you could do. Then the sermon could actually augment this. As Christians, this is the way that we should live our lives. That's a way that you could use the same exact techniques for good. And there's so many other ways that you could do that. Expressing devotion, you could get people more dedicated to God. There's so many things that you could do that is healthy using the same exact techniques, but injecting your nonsensical doctrine and all of the different things that you're doing to take the leadership and put them way up here above the people, it's just wrong.
So this is where a lot of my thought process goes now whenever planning worship sets. And a lot of it's very temporal in the sense that whatever's happening like in the community at the moment, a lot of times will influence the types of stuff that we sing. Whether that's like a national current event or the church that I'm currently at right now, there's a strong military presence. And it's not a fun time to be in the military with all the jerking around that's happening right now. And the government shutdown that happened, like that was a very interesting, interesting thing in that church because all of them were government. If they weren't military, they're civilian contractors and such. And so like, I think it was good to sing a song everybody probably knows is Goodness of God. All my life you've been faithful. All my life you've been so, so good. Like to remind ourselves that God takes care of us and that he does. He keeps us in his hand. He doesn't let us go and cares for us as his children. And to sing something like that is positive, I think, because it does. It gives people hope. It gives people security. On the flip side of that, it made me think as planning stuff, like there's times whenever I've been in worship services where I may have not agreed with the message at all, but I'm there as a paid person to get back up and do some music after the preacher preaches his sermon. And even if I think what he said was destructive and harmful and everything else, I do take solace because sometimes those songs that I can sing afterwards leave more of an impression than the sermon did. And we can sing things that are a little bit better. I'll leave it at that. We'll say that leave people with a good taste in their mouth. To know that, I'm trying to think like the end goal varies week to week and experience to experience of what you want people to feel. But whenever I end a service, I always end it with a benediction still to this day. Picked that up in my Methodist circles that I ran in where I just do the Lord bless you and keep you and make his face shine upon you, be gracious to you and give you peace and go in peace and be at peace. And we'll see you next Sunday. That's how I end almost every Sunday. And I look around the room whenever I do that. And as I say, I usually open my eyes when I'm like, go in peace, be at peace. And I look around the room and I see peace on people's face. And that's what people need right now. There's so much turmoil in the world, like for people to feel settled. And you look around and these aren't charismatic people that I'm doing stuff with now. These are Baptist folks. And I look around the room and all of them have their eyes closed and you know, slight grins on their face kind of thing. Like they just feel at peace in the moment. And those, that's the good for me. I still can't personally, like you, I still can't listen to Christian music a whole lot without just being angry. If I'm being honest, like that's where it sends me into a place of anger. But these, just like any art, it's a tool given to us by God to help us, experience God, to help us experience beauty, to help, us feel emotions and process emotions, and to cope. And I think for a lot of musicians, at least for us privately, like music is a huge coping tool, be able to bang on the guitar for a little bit, scream at the top of my lungs and sing. It helps us process and it helps us make sense of things. And I think that we get to bring other people into that. And that's the gift of music, is whether they can play it or sing it or whatever, we can bring them into that moment and hopefully something good happens.
Absolutely. You know, I struggle with the music. I've mentioned that actually at a few times, but there are things that a lot of people don't recognize because of the music style. One of the things that I like doing is I love to listen to Jack Johnson. And yeah, believe it or not, his Curious George album is my favorite because it is near to impossible to get angry while you're listening to a Jack Johnson song.
Yep.
And at the same time, he energizes you, he inspires you. You can actually hear more of God in a Jack Johnson song than you can half the songs I grew up singing in the church.
Yeah.
And to the people who, I know that there's a subset of our listeners who are going to comment on what I just said and say, but he doesn't sing about Jesus. You can't say this. He's not singing about God. The problem that I have is the music is just one aspect that has done this, but through the music, the sermons, the literature, the posters on the wall, all of the manipulation techniques,
banners, they
have so disconnected the people from the real God that they will say things like this. And I'll never forget the moment as I was leaving, as I was preparing my mind to leave from the Branham cult, I kept getting these songs. I'm a songwriter too. I kept getting these songs over and over. And one of them, many of the phrases were like, many of the songs were to this same theme, but one of the phrases was, God didn't come to save the saved, he came to save the lost. And I was actually thinking about the body of people, how charged they were against outsiders, how charged they were against other Christians. And I, at that point in time, I didn't recognize that it was a manipulation causing it. I just thought the people had gone nuts. Yeah. But now that I'm looking into the music is doing it. It's supercharging you against people who aren't of the same mindset, to the extent that if somebody comes into the church who doesn't believe like you, you're immediately offended. Get out of here. You're not part of us. Get out of here. And that's not what church is. Church is not to forsake those who don't believe like you. It's actually to inspire them to come and learn more about the God and the doctrines that you believe. And if you truly believe those doctrines and believe that that's the right way and God's working on them, if you believe that and you believe what God is all powerful, God will change their heart. It's not your job to scorn them into change. But I look back at the music and even the music is scornful. So That's why I have a huge problem listening to it, and that's why I like Jack Johnson. So go get the Curious George album, and you'll love me for it.
Amen.
Thank you for doing this, man.
Absolutely, anytime.
Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.